You know that some people call Jesus the bread man? And if he was a redhead, he'd be called the gingerbread man. Okay, that wasn't from me. That was from Casey Barnes, everybody. That was a good one. If we haven't met, my name is Sam McLaughlin, and I'm the senior pastor here at Bellmead. And we are so glad that you're here to worship with us. If you're online or listening to our sermon podcast, we welcome you as well. Each week, I've been telling you about our Wednesday night gathering. We come for dinner from 5 to 6 o'clock, and then we have a Lent service here in the sanctuary at 6:15. And this week, we have Rick Thiel. Give a little, raise your hand. Come on. Rick Thiel will be sharing about our statement today, which is, I am the bread of life. And Elizabeth Barnes and Vaughn Manning will be leading. Oh, yeah, she's cheering back there. Two of our youth will be leading our music. So we hope that you'll come out on Wednesday night at 6:15. During this season of Lent, these 40 days where we're walking closely with Jesus, learning from him, watching him, we have been looking at the I am statements of Jesus found in the book of John. Actually, our journey began back in Exodus chapter 3, where God says for the first time, I am who I am. In this story, God comes to Moses in the form of a burning bush, calls him and sends him to Egypt to bring the people out of slavery. And he, as we talked about, leads them through the Red Sea, parts the sea, and then leads them through the wilderness. And so we said, when we start to ask the question, who is God? Who is I am? There are things that the story of the Exodus can tell us. God says, I'm the God of your ancestors. I'm the God of your past, the God of your family. I've seen you through before, and I will see you through again. I'm the God who sees and hears and knows your suffering. And so I come to deliver you, to bring you out. I am the God who sees a way when sometimes you don't see a way, right? I make a way when everything in front of you looks impossible. As we started to look at the I am statements in the book of John, part of what we're saying is that the same God of the Old Testament is the same God of the New Testament, right? Jesus is calling upon these images and expanding them for us. And so we looked at last week, I am the light of the world. And we looked at two stories that helped us think about the function of light. And so there are many different things that light does, but one thing light can do is help us to expose and examine and illuminate our own sin, right? To look at ourselves and see places where we've missed the mark and we're looking for change and transformation and behavior that looks differently than maybe what we did already. We're saying that Jesus helps us to look at that sin, but also does not shame us, right? This is a really important claim about I am. God is not a shaming God. And so God, as the light of the world, helps to illuminate our shame and our sin and get rid of it within us. Today, we're talking again about the statement, I am the bread of life. And I want to point out, which I think is pretty simple to see, that the light of the world and the bread of life, these are common everyday things that we see and that we experience. And I think that that's part of the point, right? When you see the light above your head or the light that is flickering on the communion table or the light of the sun, you are meant to think God. You know, when you sit down with your family or you share bread across the table, you are meant to thank God. God is everywhere. God is all encompassing. God is found in the feasting at the table, not just in the physical food, but in the social and emotional ways that we connect. And again, as we look at all these statements in the book of John, Jesus is expanding this imagery that we have already been given. Expanding our idea of who God is and where God is. And so as we talk about I'm the bread of life, I really want to talk about chapter 6, but we're going to do it in a nutshell, okay? We're going to get through it kind of quickly, but it's really got some good stuff. So it starts with Jesus having been going through the countries, the cities, and doing miracles. In the book of John, sometimes those are called signs. And because of all these miracles that he is performing, he has a following, you know, he has a crowd that's coming after him. And so at the beginning of this chapter, he is sitting on a mountainside with his disciples, and a crowd starts to come toward him. Now, he's teaching them, he's talking to them, and he starts to be concerned with feeding them. And so he asks Philip, one of his disciples, where should we buy some bread? And Philip responds in a really practical way. He's like, Jesus, even if we pool all of our money together, everybody who's sitting here would only get one tiny bite of bread. Like, it's not going to work. And so then Andrew, another disciple, pipes up and he says, well, here's a boy who has 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus is like, now you're talking, right? And so he takes the loaves and he takes the fish and he thanks God, he blesses them, and he tells his disciples to distribute them among the crowd. And they distribute the food and everybody eats. And don't you know that there are 12 baskets of leftovers? And so here we have this miracle. We have this moment where there isn't just enough when things look scarce. There's more than what is needed. There's a surplus. There's a stockpile. There's a storehouse. And so later that evening, after this has just taken place, the disciples get on a boat to cross a lake to go to another region. Jesus does not get on the boat with them. And they're in the middle of the lake, and this big storm comes, and they're terrified. They're afraid for their lives, and they call out for Jesus. So this is the story about Jesus walking on water to get to them. He tells them not to be afraid, to trust him in the middle of shaky seas, something we still need to hear, right? And when he gets to the other side, there are people who noticed that Jesus never got on the boat in the first place. So they begin to ask questions. You know, no other boat left the shore. How in the world did you get over here? And Jesus says to them, I know that you're asking me questions about the storm and about the boat, but what you really want to know is how I fed all those people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. And so Jesus says to them, do not work for the food that spoils, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Now, the people in these stories in the Gospel of John and in other places are going to ask really logical, practical, rational questions. They say, well, what kind of work must we do? And Jesus says, this is the work of God, to believe in the one who he sent. And so they say to Jesus, well, can you give us a sign? Can you give us a miracle? Which feels ironic to me because they've just witnessed one, right? They say, you know what? God kind of did this miracle back in the Exodus. He gave the Israelites manna every day in the wilderness. And Jesus says, look, God gives you now the true bread from heaven. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. He's talking about something deeper, right? And so the people begin to grumble. They begin to ask more questions, again, that are logical. What do you mean you're the bread from heaven? Like, I know your mom and I know your dad, and you didn't come from heaven. And Jesus then repeats himself, I'm the bread of life. I'm the living bread. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. And so again, another important question is asked, how can this man give his flesh to be eaten? And Jesus goes on to say, my flesh is food, my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me and I in them. This kind of holy mystery, confusing theology, right? Is Jesus saying that we will literally eat his flesh and drink his blood? No, that's not how I interpret it. That's not really how our tradition interprets it. I believe what he's saying is, I'm going to offer my flesh and my blood so that death and sin and evil and injustice can be defeated forever. And he is drawing a correlation between his life in God and the people's life in him. Just as God sent me, and I live because I'm connected to the source, to the bread of life, so anyone who feeds on me will live because of me, because you are connected to the bread of heaven. Now, what happens at the very end of the chapter is something we don't often talk about. I'm not sure if we ever even really notice it. Some of the disciples who had been following him can't get on board with this. They don't understand it. And so at this point, they leave. They say, you know what? I'm done with Jesus. This isn't adding up. This doesn't make sense to me. This is where we depart. And Jesus, I guess, sort of concerned, looks at the 12 disciples and he says, well, are you going to leave me? And this is what Simon Peter says. He says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. And so here, Peter is illustrating what Jesus has said about the kind of work that we do. Your work is to believe in the Holy One of God. As I thought about this moment, it brought me a lot of comfort to think about that there are these moments, these times when we're unsure about what we hear. We're unsure about different theologies and ideologies centered around the table or other things in our faith. We have doubts. There are things that don't make sense and don't add up. But Peter says, we came to believe and to know. It wasn't as if the disciples began that way, right? Their journey of walking with him and watching him and following him led them to believe. And so, you know, what may be required of us is to be on the journey, to keep showing up, to have faith that asks questions and has doubts and continues to grow. It is the journey that helps you to come to believe and to know in Jesus. Now, as we look at this bread of life statement and all these teachings of bread that are happening in this passage, first, we definitely see the very real meeting of people's physical hunger needs, right? Like, it's important that if we have bread, we share it. If we have resources, we make sure that others are fed. But of course, as the chapter progresses and the language gets deeper, Jesus is talking about this spiritual hunger, this spiritual thirst. Like, Jesus is a bread that satiates and satisfies on a deeper level. This bread that is worth craving. A couple of months ago, this fall actually, one of our church members named Cara Miller, who is a dietitian, taught a parenting class on nutrition and other things that parents might be able to help their kids with when it comes to food. And one of the things she introduced to us that none of you are going to be able to see from there is called the hunger scale. I wondered how it might translate into our spiritual hunger. You know, like if someone is to ask you, like, what is your spiritual hunger? Can you rate it from 1 to 10? What does it look like? Right? If one is maybe spiritually empty, you know, like that place where maybe faith feels shallow or it feels performative or even non-existent, right? Maybe being spiritually empty is a good thing. Maybe like if we're so hungry for God and in such a difficult place, that is where God does God's best work. You know, I've found that to be true in my life at times. I mean, and don't we always sort of need a little hunger for God, right? Maybe a 6 on the spiritual hunger scale is where we find ourselves spiritually sound. Like, all of these practices in my life are working. I feel like spiritual depth and strength and endurance. I feel steady in my faith. Maybe a 10 is that place, not where, like, if you're eating temporal food, you feel sick, but if you're eating eternal food and you're at a 10, you have this fullness that is ready to be emptied out for other people. Like, you are brimming. You are on that, like, overflow level. Like, you've just come home from a mission trip, or you've just had some spiritually high experience. So where are you on that scale for spiritual hunger? And which naturally begs the next question, what are you consuming daily that serves you spiritually? You know, I think what Jesus is combating in this chapter is this urge that all of us have to find what fulfills us temporarily and instantly, right? Like, we are a culture of quick fix. We find instant gratification, and we can be tricked into thinking that that is the gift, that that is what satisfies. But we know that it only satisfies for so long, right? It's like trying to find a bread substitute. Like, it's okay, but it's not really the real thing, you know? Like, give me the bread. We can treat other things in our lives as substitutes for the bread of life. You know, what do I mean by that? I mean, like, we wake up in the morning and the very first thing we do is put our phone in front of our face, right? And like, whatever messaging or input or influencers that we hear or watch or read, they fuel us with something. But is it helpful? Is it life-giving? Is it true sustenance? Last night, I was putting my daughter to bed. Her name is Madeline, and she's 2.5 years old. And she's having a little bit of trouble going to sleep right now. And so I was trying to, you know, parents just do a lot of different experiments until you hit the right thing that works. And so I said, Madeline, we're going to read one book. We're going to sing 2 songs, and then you're going to get in the bed. And I don't care if you have, like, something that sings to you all night in your bed, or you just lay there reading for an hour. Don't yell mommy and daddy, right? It normally works to tell a 2-year-old not to scream. That doesn't work, people. And so I'm sitting in the chair with her, and she picks up this play phone, and she hands me a book to read, which is actually a book that you sing. And so I start to sing and flip the pages, and she starts pushing all the numbers, and then she clicks on the phone something that plays a song. And so, like, while I'm trying to sing to her, she is interrupting me with a phone that sings a song. And so I take the phone and I put it down and I turn it off. And then we begin to sing our songs, and then she picks it up and she turns it back on, and she's holding it like this close to her face while I am trying to sing to her. And I thought in that moment, like, is this what she feels like? Is this what she feels like when I, as a parent, am looking at my phone, lost in whatever messaging is probably not serving me, instead of giving her attention? Instead of paying attention to my family, which is a slice of the kingdom of heaven for me, right? As a part of that bread of life. Maybe for you, it's not your phone or social media or influencers. Maybe you turn on the news and you let it cycle all day long, and you're being fed different voices and narratives that, like, may or may not be true. You know, how do you feel when you leave that space? Are you full, or are you depleted and angry at the world and afraid? You know, we feast on the words of our colleagues and our friends and family members, and that can be informative and it can be helpful, but is it the same as the discerning wisdom of the bread of life? Maybe it's texting or shopping or gambling. You know what I mean. Like, do these activities make us spiritually full and deeply satisfying? Through this series, I've been reading a book by Matt Rawl. He's a good writer, and he's another United Methodist pastor. And the book is called Jesus Revealed, the I Am Statements in the Gospel of John. So quite relevant to our series. And as I read his chapter on the bread of life, I really liked something that he pointed out. He points out that 3 times in this short narrative about the feeding, Jesus reiterates that people should sit down. Okay, so he's sitting with his disciples. We actually talked about this last week in our story when he's doing teaching in the temple. He's sitting down with the people on the floor. So Jesus is sitting with his disciples. When the crowd comes, he tells them to sit 2 times. And then they're sitting as they have this sort of like big picnic of loaves and fishes. And so Matt's point in pointing this out is that sitting is a posture of rest. It's a posture of trust. It's a posture of abundance. And as people who kind of live day to day, sometimes hour to hour, we can find ourselves in that mode of scarcity. We ask our question, ourselves, are we going to have enough time to do that? Are we going to have enough patience? Are we going to have enough strength? He's saying here that instead of feeding off scarcity, like only 5 loaves and 2 fish, which leaves us pacing the floor and filled with anxiety and constantly worrying, Jesus is inviting us into his mode of living, where we're not hurrying and rushing everywhere, where every day there is a miracle of enough. Actually, there is a miracle of a surplus, of a stockpile, of a storehouse. And so for humans that run dry and run on empty and find ourselves hangry, to me, that is a delectable, divine invitation. Come, sit, relax, have your fill. And guess what? There's more where that came from. And church, that is the invitation to the table of Jesus Christ, a place where we sit and we gather and we feast on the bread of life. Here, there is not a short supply. There is not a quick fix. There is not a substitute. Here, there is an eternal storehouse. A daily dose, a more dense, more nutrient-rich, more fulfilling way to live your life. Here, we are meant to be blessed by the breaking of the bread and the drinking of the cup of life. And then, like the disciples, we are sent to distribute the food, right? We are sent to trail the world with breadcrumbs that offer a taste of the bread from heaven. May it be so. Amen.